Welcome to My Property World, a light and informative look at all things property. We have designed this series for people involved in property and property finance in the UK market. However, we do take examples from all around the property world. Our aim is for us to make money from property together, whether that be buying, selling, financing, trading, or getting involved in a deal in another way. We do this by informing, entertaining, and enjoying ourselves talking property, which gives you a chance to get to know us, what we're up to, and to check us out until you're ready to make money together. In the meantime, My Property World is free and fun, so plug in your headphones and enjoy. We would love for you to like, share, and comment, so please do on social media. And if you have questions, ideas for topics, or deals you would like to explore, we're always looking for guests, so get in touch via the My Property World profile.
This meeting is being recorded.
Hello and welcome to another episode of My Property World. I'm Will Mellor and I'm delighted to be joined by the author of the Sunday Supplement, Adam Lawrence. Great to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me again, Will.
So, Adam, could you give the listeners not familiar with your work a quick summary of your own background and why there's a Sunday Supplement?
Sure thing, Will. So my brief dalliance with corporate employment involved a stint working in Switzerland in a couple of boutique wealth management houses, where I went from zero to slightly above zero in terms of my own financial acuity and got a little bit of a chance to learn how the super rich protect and develop their assets, which was great. And then also a little bit of time as an internal consultant for one of the UK's top 10 lenders. But all the rest of the time, I've been unemployable / entrepreneurial, including running, heading up a betting syndicate over 10 years ago now. But for the past decade, for my sins, I've been heavily involved in the UK property market, primarily residential. So I've done around about 500 deals, most of which I've held on to, some of which I've gone to sell on. But the goal is to build a nice portfolio, done most of that, nearly all of it in joint ventures. So been reasonably busy, Will. And the reason why the supplement exists, sorry you asked, is because my background from an academic perspective is in economics. I think economics is the most fascinating and important subject of all. And I think, you know, largely speaking, with a little bit of spit and polish, you can generally control most of the things at the micro level within property, in terms of the product that you're offering, in terms of the tenant type that you're using, in terms of the location and all the rest of it. But what you can't control are the macro factors, including the interest rate. So the interest rate is such a big, big part of what we do as property investors. It hasn't been for the past decade, but right now it is. And the interest rate and everything associated with that on a macro level are incredibly important. And I write the supplement in order to keep myself abreast of everything, put my thoughts down on paper, invite thoughts from other people who like to comment on a weekly basis, and just get the grey cells whirring, really, Will.
And that's fantastic. And our role as property investors, as I'm fond of saying, is that we're to look into the future and I suppose decide what might be. And if we can see a little bit clearer what's coming around the corner, we can make better calls today. We can allocate resources or withdraw them from particular areas within our portfolios, or figure out different ways to invest. And if we do that well, on average, we're going to end up a little bit further ahead than otherwise. What I would encourage anyone to do is to pop on to partners-property.com. Subscribe to the blog, which is where the Sunday Supplement articles, which is Adam's economic column, which we're going to get into now, is available. I'm a super fan. He's a super forecaster in the making, and I'm delighted that he's on the show today. So, Adam Lawrence, let's get into this week's supplement. People who are joining at some point in the future, we're covering the 23rd of October. Feel free to go back on to partners-property.com, look up the column, and it's a great read to have alongside the the episode of this podcast.
Thanks, Will. And I like to start every week on the supplement with a quote. And this week I went for, the trick is this, keep your eye on the ball, even when you can't see the ball. And that's from Tom Robbins, the American novelist.
So that's fantastic. Why did you pick that this week?
Because this week, really, we're looking again at inflation in a slightly different way. And the last sort of 3 to 4 weeks, or perhaps 6 or 7 weeks, we haven't really looked too closely at inflation. We've had a wobble in the government bond markets, which meant that instead financial stability has taken to the forefront of that. And, you know, we can certainly blame the temporary administration that came in and had less success than almost any football manager I can remember. We shouldn't really be joking about it because we're talking about running the entire United Kingdom. And the point is, inflation has really not been mentioned particularly for about 6 or 7 weeks, even though it slipped under the headlines that we went back over double digits in terms of the official measure for September.
And past readers of the supplement would be aware it's been mentioned consistently since at least February 21.
That's right. And it's been a big factor even before it reared its head. And then since it went over the 2% mandated threshold around about September last year, it's just continued on the wax. And the problem is, when do we get over that hill? And inflation at this sort of level is very, very damaging to the fabric of society, not just to the economy, you know, so it really is that serious.
And this is big stuff. So on to the supplement.
Okay, so we've had another unbelievable week, really, Will. I'm going to refrain too much on commenting upon the departure of the weakest Prime Minister for some time. I'm going to leave out the comments around comparison to vegetables. Sorry about that one. That really is the only poor quality gag I'm going to make about lettuces.
Sorry, not sorry.
And I'm going to sidestep what could be an even bigger mistake in terms of the potential return of Boris Johnson, and simply hope that those in positions of power can, for once, make a half-decent decision which would see economic stability return to the UK. I guess we're going to find out by the time next week's supplement is published, because that's the timeline. So, but as I said, what's concerning me while all this mayhem has been playing out is the things we've stopped talking about, because there have been, temporarily, bigger fish to fry. There have been the obligatory 40-year headlines around inflation as it ticked back over 10% in September on official figures, but they quickly faded into the background of political turmoil. My bigger concern is that this wave is still not being taken seriously enough. So,
And you're talking central banking here.
Absolutely. I'm talking central banking and I'm talking fiscal policy, which, you know, was on the right track, or somewhere towards the right track, and then the train has left the tracks after we've had four chancellors in 4 months, effectively. So, but really, we need to draw back to the primary issue that the world has faced since COVID, because COVID, of course, prompted incredible levels of stimulus into economies around the world, which can only ever be inflationary in nature. In the post-COVID world, or in most of it, demand is larger than it was pre-COVID, but supply has been a major issue. This has then been massively exacerbated by the war in Ukraine, where energy supply, or the supply of raw materials to be converted into usable energy, has become a significant problem. But there's a factor which I've not spoken about in any great detail around the supplement, which is waiting in the wings to have a significant impact, and that's the Chinese approach towards their zero COVID policy. President Xi is moving into an unprecedented third term, and thus an overall change of direction in a hurry is unlikely. However, at some point, as and when China is back fully online, monstrous consumer of energy and raw materials that it is, supply shortages will be felt ever further. This in itself will have an impact on global inflation and will mean further upward pressure. So a little hat tip towards the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, Will, because the USA has been deploying its Strategic Petroleum Reserve for the past year or so, with around 280 million barrels of their full reserve capacity of 714 million barrels being drawn down.
So over a third.
Yeah, and this puts the SPR at its lowest level for the past ever since it started being filled beyond this level in the first place in the 1980s. This has helped to control the price of gasoline at the US petrol pumps and made a significant difference to inflation in the USA, which has taken a different shape to the UK inflation and has, before recent months, had more core inflation issues than the UK has had. So core issues are non-food, non-energy, although the UK core inflation has recently overtaken the US core. And it's the core we're really interested in. Yeah, so we were interested in watching the core, Will, because if we strip out energy for a start, and then, of course, energy has a knock-on effect to food, not just in terms of how food is produced, but also in terms of how food gets from the farms to the shelves in the simplest possible way. We're then saying, okay, well, not considering these exogenous shocks that we've been seeing, right, what's really happening to inflation? And what's happening in core terms for both the UK and the US is that inflation is above 6%. So in the US, it's being pushed dramatically by the cost of services and the cost of goods as well. In the UK, we've got a slightly different approach because if you look at the surveys at the moment, US consumer confidence is doing reasonably well, even though they're technically in a recession because they've had two quarters of negative growth, but it's been very shallow negative growth. And of course, as the oil, as petrol prices got more and more and more expensive, and they hit kind of a bit of a bump, and then the SPR drawdown has helped bring them right back down, the consumers have got their confidence back. Whereas in the UK, consumer confidence has never been so low. Retail sales were down about 1.5% in September, which is a significant drop, although that did also include the Queen's passing, which had some impact and, of course, injected that extra bank holiday as well into the economy. But the mourning period certainly had a little bit of impact. But there's a big divergence between how the consumers are feeling at the moment. And that ultimately impacts how much people consume, because from an economic perspective, when people have got money coming into their households, they're either consuming it or they're saving it. It really is as simple as that. It's a binary choice.
And the significance of that to a property investor is what?
Well, ultimately, we're looking at wages. Wage inflation is extremely important to us in terms of the affordability of rental housing. If we're renting properties to people, if we're involved in things like short-term lettings, we're interested in the market price that's being paid. We're also interested in why and when do companies need to move people around the UK on a temporary basis? Because we're looking at, you know, short letting equivalents. And then that ultimately also filters through into public sector projects. At the top end, things like HS2, at the smaller end, perhaps sort of more local levelling up style projects. How far are they going forward? How are they affecting people involved in short-term rentals, hotels, all the rest of it? You know, the hotel sector at the moment is under significant pressure in terms of capacity because there's more temporary accommodation than there has been. Some of that's to do with COVID fallout. Some of that's to do with refugees from various different countries. It's all quite complex, really, Will. But we need to keep a close eye on inflation because it's going to define how much rents move up over time. It's also going to define things like political stability at the top end, which we've seen the sort of start, you know, strikes are the start of these problems. There are far bigger problems potentially in the pipe for this year. And we also need to understand how much...
That inflation driver, like I think you've summarised really well the significance to an investor, or as investors, we need to be aware of what's coming down the track a little bit.
Absolutely.
And your central thesis at the moment is there's some more inflationary pressures coming, and that they're not necessarily from within.
That's right. Exactly right. So the significant drawdown in the strategic petroleum reserve at a time before China is back online in a big way could be very damaging indeed, because the US has already used its cushion, and a significant impact of Chinese inflation now has a much smaller safety net behind it. you know, we have to remember in the context of these conversations where most of the world's oil comes from, and Russia are the second biggest player in the market in the world. They have a very, very big influence, and it's difficult to make an argument that Russia doesn't have a very bad actor in charge at the moment who still has a few crazy tools up his sleeve. So the plan is to wait for oil's price to drop before filling the reserve. The problem with this tactic being that crude prices are likely to jump significantly as and when China needs far more of it to get its economy back to full speed. So, as you were saying, Will, this is another uncontrollable source of inflation for the UK. Now, we've seen the primary mandate of the central bank, which is to control inflation, to keep it at or around target of 2%, take a back seat thanks to this political instability of the past few weeks. The central banks had to perform an even more important role to stabilise the UK's position as a significant borrower of monies from the international money markets in the past month or so. So this had provided an opportunity to shoehorn in a significant rise in the base rate at the next monetary policy meeting, which is November the 3rd. This opportunity looks to be slipping through the hands of the bank as they insist that rates will not be climbing as high as the markets expect. The more I look at the governance and ability at the very top of the bank, the less I'm impressed at the moment. There seems to be no obvious reason why bank rates can top out lower than the markets think. And indeed, I still think that the inflation risks are understated, not overstated, which means higher rates than anyone thinks, not lower.
And this is, in your opinion, before this Chinese / oil pressure?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So
there's two enormous factors which are going to almost undoubtedly have an impact on the inflation rate. Oh. And even before that, they're not doing enough in terms of tightening the screws and putting rates up higher.
Well, the SPR drawdowns is driving the price of crude down, and that's the plan of it in general. The issue is, I'm not convinced, OPEC Plus of the cartel that effectively controls the price of oil or tries to heavily influence the price of oil, let's say, has cut its production quotas by 2 million barrels a day. That's a significant amount of oil. You know, places like Saudi produce around 12 million barrels a day. Saudi is the biggest producer of oil in the world. So 2 million a day is significant, although they weren't producing up at those levels anyway. The SPR is being drawn down at a rate of between about 3 million and 7 million barrels a week. So, half a million to a million barrels a day, that's how much difference it's making at the moment. And if you do the maths from earlier on, there's about 430, 440 million barrels left. You wouldn't want to see the SPR emptied out altogether, especially without a truly significant reason for doing so. So it shows you that mathematically, there's about a year to a year and a half's worth of SPR drawdown before it starts to cause a real problem.
So Aramco stock is rising even in nominal terms or in real terms.
I pointed out a short while ago that Buffett was quietly as Berkshire Hathaway ever can do, buying up some shares in oil production companies. Occidental was his main choice. And that just shows you, the whole ESG movement is predicated on some false premises or just ignoring the chief argument about how we actually transition from fossil to renewable without causing a gigantic global shock, which will kill potentially far more people than global warming will kill. And it's one of the more difficult conversations you can have in finance or around the dinner table or in macro. There's no two ways about it, Will.
And if you take a simple definition of the purpose of a society or an economy is to improve the lives of people within it, if they're dying, it's probably not doing what it says on the tin.
Yep, recession's the number one most damaging thing. This is a theme that's hit home throughout COVID, for example. Something like COVID is a difficult thing to process for people because COVID made everybody's lives worse. There's no two ways about it. But the reaction to COVID and what needed to be considered in terms of saving lives now versus saving lives in the medium term was very, very, very politically difficult. And it had to be made with imperfect information, which made that so tough. But the answer of lock everything down now, anyone who didn't lock anything down now has made a mistake, was ultimately not the correct one. The also never have a lockdown ever attitude was also not the correct one. And that's what made it so very difficult until there was at least a bit of better information. But part of the problem, I would argue, with the government response was that if you give all the responsibility to extremely risk-averse scientists whose job isn't to, for example, manage the macroeconomy or really even do the maths, then you're going to have one particular way of thinking rather than a holistic way of thinking via a committee of advisors, let's say. But anyway, enough potential conspiracy theories aside. There is an alternative, Will, to raising rates until things break by the central bank, a relatively simple disinflationary path. Because as we approach the sort of 5-6% sort of pay rate for mortgages, particularly 5.5% has been the number that's been key over the last decade or so, every 25 basis points we go above 5.5%, we're pushing people into what's been uncharted territory for the last nearly 15 years. We were on that path of disinflation under the chancellorship of Rishi Sunak.
Yeah, and we're talking mortgages and rent.
Absolutely, because he was looking at tax increases. So the logic's fairly simple. If you take the money out of people's pockets in tax, it leaves less money to consume, which calms down demand. You know, the biggest single factor to inflation is consumption, Will. And if you can calm that down, you can stop prices moving up quite so quickly. Even better, it funds public services rather than borrowing money to do so. No entrepreneur likes to see higher taxes. In fact, nobody does. But this is, or was, a far better way to address the current situation and the gigantic wealth transfer from the government to the households that was achieved in 2020. Than simply raising rates until the cost of living crushes the bottom 20 to 40% of society. The complete reversal of this, which was attempted by Lettice Trust and Kwasi Kwarteng, was rightly shunned as total and utter economic idiocy, and as discussed, has now been mostly reversed. The Sunak 1.25% rise in national insurance would have been better preserved, but the 1% drop in income tax, which has now been cancelled, has also helped to prove to international markets fiscal responsibility is still the number one priority of the UK Treasury. Will we see that approach come back? Either way, it looks like Hunt remains as Chancellor at the moment, and that's a comparative rarity. The incoming PM will need to work with him. His removal would cause too many jitters in the bond markets, which have come back to functionality, at least temporarily. We must turn our attention, though, into what this actually means for UK property and how we as investors attempt to navigate the upcoming choppy seas and continue to take our portfolios forwards. I've made no secret of my thoughts on the interest rate and the direction of travel over the past 9 months or so. Be philosophical about early repayment charges, cost of doing business sometimes. Fix low, enjoy stability and cash flow for the next 5 years plus. That's fine if you've taken action, but if not, or if you're still looking to expand your portfolio, then what now? Well, some quarters seem to be suggesting moving on to variable rates. And some more attractive variable rates seem to be out there with larger product fees, but there's significant risk inherent in this strategy. If the fiscal policy calming approach doesn't work as well, and taxes can't be raised much further, whoever is in power, then we still have interest rates moving up to a level that the central bank doesn't want to countenance or accept. Loans subject to that base rate could spend some time, longer than expected if I'm on the right lines, at levels that look like bridging loan rates or even higher. With commitment periods, arrangement fees, legals and repayment charges, it could be potentially cheaper to be on a bridge at a fixed rate, especially as bridging loans has as yet remained insulated from the rate rises that have ripped through the rest of the industry. If base does move to 7% or above for any sustained period, it will be that feeling of being near the peak, but also not knowing just how high things could go. And at those sort of levels, every 0.25% would have a significant impact on capital values.
And that interaction between capital values and interest rates, what's the basic equation for people to consider?
Well, the number one explainer, when you look at the data over the past sort of 60 or 70 years of house prices, The number one piece of correlation has been with the availability of credit, Will. So that's the time we can all remember, you know, 2008, 2009, 2007, credit was so widely available. You barely had to have a pulse to get a mortgage, and you could get 100% mortgage, if not higher.
And as an investor, if you could walk and chew gum, you could get money and you could make money.
Exactly, exactly. Day one refinances, all gifted deposits, all sorts of smoke, mirrors and trickery in the industry. And that's what really evaporated the availability of credit. So now we're dealing with something that's obviously related to the availability. We're dealing with the price of credit. Right, so this is serious. It's not as serious as the total reduction or the total removal from the market of self-certification mortgages and all the rest of it, but it is serious.
Also known as I'm okay, are you okay?
Exactly. Yeah. So my personal preference at this time, Will, would be to still fix at the higher rates. If you can achieve cash flow and you've got rent coverage, you know, no one should really need more than 60% LTV on their existing stock at this time after they've had a 25% bump in the capital values over the past 2 years. That keeps the cost and the risk down somewhat. New stock needs to have significant cash flow to offer protection against the current environment.
So, that's like a reflection of what's happened in capital values. So you bought a place at 100 3 years ago, it now should be worth 120 or 130, depending on what it is and where it is, without any other improvements.
Exactly. So people are going to ask, Will, how do I buy and what do I buy? So, you know, how do we find, talking about this cash flow, but how do we achieve it? Well, one of the following ways. We either use bigger deposits, put more equity into deals. That's never popular, but it does work. Or we have to put more layers of service or operations on each tenancy. Things like HMO, things like serviced accommodation. We're talking about more work for the same cash flow as was being achieved 12 months ago. Sure, we are, but we cannot benchmark to 12 months ago. Higher yielding property? Yes, but ensure you're looking at net yields after all costs, not attractive looking gross yields. Don't go miles away.
Take 30 seconds just to explain the difference between the two for listeners who are reconsidering what to do.
So one of the things that I've seen happen over the years, Will, is that people will want to do one of two things. They either want to invest in an area very close to home, could be 10 minutes, if there's lots of rooftops around you in London somewhere, it could be half an hour if you're a little bit further out in the provinces, right? They don't want to drive. They don't feel like they're in control if it's not close to home. Then there's the other camp who realize, you know, like a lot of the country where there's money around, they need to travel to a higher yielding area. And there becomes this temptation to gravitate up towards the northeast of England or perhaps into Scotland, where yields are higher on paper. Now, there are a number of problems that can be associated with that, such as if you go to, I won't name the auction house, but one of the certain London auctions, you'll find a portion of the catalogue that's always dedicated to very cheap houses, which yield very, very strong money on paper. And they tend to be located up in the northeast. And they tend to be, you know, ASTs that have only just been signed at maybe 400, 450, 500 quid a month. If you're lucky, what's happened is a local trader has gone to the job centre and paid someone 25 quid to put their name on an AST who doesn't actually live in the property that gets slipped into the legal pack. If you're unlucky, you find out when you've bought the property that the copper's been stripped out, the boiler's been removed and all the rest of it. So that's the sort of thing that goes on week in, week out at some of the London auction houses. So the point is, it might be 20% yield on paper, but if that's not the true rent, if no one's going to be able to occupy the property and none of the local agents will touch it because it's such a rough area, then you've obviously got 0% yield, not 20% yield. And you've bought a liability, you've bought a problem, you've bought a council tax bill every month, you've bought all of those things. So there's serious caution needed when you just go high yield. So yeah, don't go miles away from home without a robust management strategy in place. Talk to agents beforehand, you know, get some information off the ground, use your network, build your network. There are some excellent commercial yields out there at this time where some safety might be achieved, but again, you need to put the work in beforehand rather than just jumping at them.
And so commercial yields, just for the benefit of listeners.
Yeah. So there's a couple of pretty good looking yields out there at the moment. Retail has taken a bit of a beating over the past few years, mostly because of COVID. But as is so often said in these situations, the death of the high street is very much over-exaggerated. There's just repurposing that needs to take place rather than... There is an oversupply of retail stock in the country by about 10 or 15%, but you need to look at the sort of units that will rent to people versus the ones that, you know, what's unpopular at the moment, your Debenham style, 350,000 square foot, significant capex requirement going into a recession, that's problematic. Your 750 square foot single retail unit, there's normally some entrepreneur somewhere is going to have a little go at running a shop out of there, whatever they're doing with it. So it might also, Will, and this won't be popular either, but it might also be time for those who've sacked their boss to take a look at a temporary return to the labour market. You know, consultancy on a remote and or part-time basis at today's inflated rates is not the worst place you can look to be getting your next deposit from. It also seems like a good time to sweat your human capital if you are not yet 100% free of all financial obligations. Now, some of this I know feels like taking
How
cover.
Can you get some return on your time, basically?
Exactly. You know, some of it will feel like taking cover somewhat, and there's no denying that it is, Will. There's no guarantee of a drop in prices over the next couple of years, especially if inflation does keep ripping through the economy, as I'm suggesting it will. I certainly wouldn't be on the sidelines waiting for the crash, although a price adjustment post-COVID wouldn't surprise too many people. The definition of the word crash will be important. For example, we've seen relatively large adjustments to the stock and bond markets in 2022 without hearing the word crash particularly mentioned. It could be quite a soft decay in pricing. However, if employment stays high and the labour market remains tight, wages still rise and people still want houses, with that insufficient supply of both rental houses and houses to buy. So there's going to be little else we can do for the moment, but we need to stay alert, stay liquid, and watch for opportunities. I've already seen around 5 to 10 times the volume of potential deals in the past fortnight that I've been seeing for the past couple of years. Not too much of interest, but this looks like the start of a great time to buy if you can work out how to hold on to the assets and at least break even for the next couple of years if you are buying at a significant discount. The key, as so often said, will be to keep your head while all around you are losing theirs. Expect the unexpected. We are still only entering event 3 of the decathlon. Most of the past year has simply been a warm-up. Keep calm and work on making the right decisions. Not buy high, sell low.
Fantastic advice. And as mentioned at the top of the show, you can find the article dated 23rd of October on partners-property.com. And indeed, get in touch with Adam, Adam G. Lawrence on LinkedIn. Fantastic to have you on the show. And I hope to see listeners down at a local Partners in Property meetup. I'm a London member, love it. It's my favourite part of the month, really. We'll see you down at an event. Adam's often circulating in the background or indeed speaking on a topic as he is at the Bristol event this month.
Thanks ever so much, Will. Thanks for having me again. Always a pleasure.
Right, that's great. Catch you next time.
Cheers.
Welcome to My Property World, a light and informative look at all things property. We have designed this series for people involved in property and property finance in the UK market. However, we do take examples from all around the property world. Our aim is for us to make money from property together, whether that be buying, selling, financing, trading, or getting involved in a deal in another way. We do this by informing, entertaining, and enjoying ourselves talking property, which gives you a chance to get to know us, what we're up to, and to check us out until you're ready to make money together. In the meantime, My Property World is free and fun, so plug in your headphones and enjoy. We would love for you to like, share and comment, so please do on social media. And if you have questions, ideas for topics or deals you would like to explore, we're always looking for guests, so get in touch via the My Property World profile.